Martin Luther King Day is for many a national day of service, but there's plenty to be done after today, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, January 18th, and it's Martin Luther King Day. We're happy you could join us. Commemorations and peace marches are being held across the country today, but Martin Luther King Day has also become a day of service. Thousands of people volunteered today nationwide, but what happens after the holiday? Do the volunteers dry up? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look.
It's early evening on a January weeknight in Washington, D.C., and the Sasha Bruce House Shelter for Teens is buzzing. The teens are putting together collages of pictures and words symbolizing what they want to accomplish in life. President Obama chose this shelter for his first Martin Luther King Day project after the 2008 election.
He came and proceeded to paint the boys' bedroom that we have there.
James Beck is development officer at Sasha Bruce Youth Work. The boys' bedroom is still a cheery, bright blue, but President Obama left behind more than just a coat of paint. Beck says the shelter was deluged with volunteers after the visit.
People called us, people emailed us. The intensity, of course, is not the same as in the days following Obama's visit, but I think today it still lasts.
Beck says his organization kept in touch with its Martin Luther King volunteers so they would come back. Tyrone Freeman teaches philanthropic studies at Indiana University. He says there's another reason to stay in contact after a volunteer's first visit.
Frequently, that becomes the way in which organizations will recruit their donors.
Last year, more than 62 million Americans volunteered their time, according to the Corporation for National and Community Service, a federal agency that coordinates volunteer projects on Martin Luther King Day. The CEO, Wendy Spencer, says that volunteer time is money.
And we put a value on those hours and that time, and the value is $184 billion.
And Spencer says this is the biggest volunteer day of all, with projects in all 50 states, including food drives, mentoring, and construction. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Many of you who were not volunteering may have spent the day at a national park. Admission is free on MLK Day. Not that the parks need the help. Annual attendance is at an all-time high, with early numbers showing more than 300 million visits in 2015. Look for an even bigger number this year as the National Park Service celebrates its 100th birthday and low gas prices get more people on the road. Growing visits can also mean more money for the private companies connected with the parks. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on the national park economy and whether the system can handle the growth.
Many of the businesses that benefit from the national parks economy are family-operated, like Y Explore. Co-owner John DeGrazio has been taking Yosemite National Park visitors on hikes for a decade.
They are able to see some of the iconic landmarks like Half Dome, El Capitan, to connect with nature in one of the grandest national parks in America.
He says business jumped around 30% when park visits spiked last year, which meant hiring more guides. The National Park Service says visitors spend more than $15 billion a year in communities near the parks. That adds up to nearly 300,000 jobs and billions more in economic impact. Big firms benefit, too.
Our company was really founded in those national parks. Our history and our bones are very much connected to those national parks.
Jerry Stritzky is CEO of the outdoor retailer REI, which does north of $2 billion a year in sales. A few million of those go into the company's partnership with the National Park Foundation. Stritzky says it's the right thing to do for conservation and the bottom line.
As you get a younger millennial customer that's probably more attuned to environmental issues, the outdoors is appealing to that next generation.
Disney, Subaru, and others also partner with the parks. The exploding popularity also raises concerns about whether expanding crowds will strain the system. National Park Service Director John Jarvis has seen the growth firsthand, working his way from ranger to the top job.
It can be an operational challenge for our staff on the ground. I mean, we want to make sure the public have a fantastic experience and that the resource is protected as well.
He's optimistic, citing a bigger budget from Congress and technology that helps park officials steer visitors so they don't hit the same parks at the same time.
Giving them real-time trip planning information that they can know when to come and perhaps come in at a different entrance or even a different park.
As these things go, record popularity is a pretty nice problem to have. A lot of businesses, big and small, are counting on that run to continue. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, trading is closed, but oil took the opportunity to tank anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Only about 2 weeks left for people to sign up for health insurance under Obamacare. Open enrollment closes after January 31st. And when you're shopping for a new plan, you might notice a lot of cheap options that don't include a lot of doctors or hospitals. These offerings are called narrow networks. And according to the consultant group McKinsey, narrow networks now make up about half of the plans on the federal health insurance exchange. That can be tricky for consumers and for the hospitals who might be left out. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein joins us to explain. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Molly.
Before we get into how this affects hospitals, what are we talking about here? What are these narrow networks and why are they becoming so popular?
Well, so narrow networks is sort of what it sounds like. It's a limited number of doctors and hospitals that you can get within your health insurance plan. The idea behind it, Molly, is just the fewer doctors, the fewer hospitals you have, the more the insurer can control the cost. Consumers in this ACA era, they're super price sensitive, and insurers want to have as many consumers in the door as possible. So the idea with the narrow networks is if you don't want to pay a lot of money up front, then go with something really stripped down and you're going to be able to pay what seems to be a reasonable monthly premium.
So where does that leave hospitals and doctors? What steps are they trying to take to make sure that they are included in some of these plans?
Right. So like the basic play, the historic play here, Molly, has been hospitals have told insurers, we're going to cut 10 to 15% off of our prices. And in exchange, you drive your customers to us. You drive all your patients to us. And there's the kind of like win-win. In this new era, that's not enough. In this new era, hospitals have to say to the insurers, you want to work with us because we're going to be able to save you money, not just in year one, but in year two and in year three, because we're changing how we deliver healthcare. We're going to find efficiencies. We're going to do things in a different way. And that's really easy to say, Molly. Lots and lots and lots of people are talking about it all the time, but very few hospitals have figured out exactly how to do it. So right now, everybody's kind of, it's almost like a game of musical chairs a little bit where partners are trying to like dance with each other and figure out what's going on and who really can deliver what. So that's one option, like this sort of reform of how we're providing care to patients. Another option that some hospitals are considering is like saying, you know what, we're going to get into the insurance business ourselves and we're going to create our own narrow networks. So that's how that's going to work. And that's innovative, but it's a high risk strategy, right? Like that's not the game of delivering healthcare, which is what hospitals have done. That's getting into a new business. So it's potentially great, but it's also potentially risky.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty interesting time. But so what does this mean for the consumer, for the last minute shoppers who are looking for care right now or people who are worried about limited options?
Well, so I think people have to be really clear about this. I mean, I think you know and I know healthcare is so jargon rich. It's really confusing. We all know we need it at some point in one way or another, but like what it is and how it works is so confusing to so many of us. And there's this interesting report from McKinsey that came out recently, the consultant group McKinsey, who said about 25%, 26% of people who bought a plan on the exchange didn't even know that they were, what kind of, whether it was a broad network or a narrow network. And people've got to know if you're sick, particularly if you're sick and you have a really like special condition, who is covered and who isn't covered in terms of hospitals and doctors really can matter. I mean, this, not to be glib, I mean, but this really is sort of life and death for some people. Most of the people, it's going to be okay, right? Most people don't need super hyper specialized care, but some do. And for those who do, they need to make sure they're in a plan that's going to give them the coverage that they need.
That's Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thanks, Molly.
Texas leads the nation in the number of refugee resettlements. It's taken in more than 80,000 over the past 10 years, and most of them come to Houston. However, in the wake of recent national security concerns, state officials are pushing to block Syrian refugees from entering. But many Houston residents say that won't dampen their welcoming spirit. From Houston Public Media, Saida Hassan reports.
Haider Elias says languages are kind of his thing. He's fluent in four, and he put those skills to work as a translator for the U.S. military in Iraq. Since moving to Houston 6 years ago, he's picked up a few new phrases.
The hasta la vista is one that I liked. It's always see you whenever you want, you know.
Elias and his family came to the U.S. as refugees. They're Yazidis, members of the Iraqi religious minority that's been persecuted by ISIS. Like almost 40% of all refugees who come to Texas, they resettled in Houston. Elias found work within a month at a computer manufacturing company.
I already spoke good English and I already knew how to apply for jobs. It didn't take me very long, actually, to find a job, but that was not the kind of job I was looking for.
Today, Elias works from home as a freelance translator, and he's a U.S. citizen. But when he first got to Houston, he didn't have a lot of options. Refugees don't get to decide where they resettle in the U.S. Cities are assigned to them based on a number of factors, where they have friends or family, and what kind of economic opportunities they'll find.
One of the advantages we have in Houston is we have many jobs available for people who are new.
Sarah Kaufman is the Houston Director for Refugee Services of Texas, a nonprofit resettlement agency. She says most refugees the group works with are employed within 4 to 5 months. With thousands more coming to Houston each year, Kaufman says lots of local businesses see an advantage in hiring them.
We have some people who call us when they have job opportunities coming up because they know refugees are ambitious, they work hard, they're really committed to doing well in their work. And so I think employers recognize that and see refugees as a great hire for them.
But Houston's history of welcoming newcomers has been challenged recently. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been a vocal opponent of resettling Syrian refugees in the state.
Texas is saying no more.
That's Abbott speaking to Fox News in November. The state has since gone to court to fight the federal government over refugee placement. But that's not been echoed by leaders in Houston.
This city has a heart.
That's Mary Lee Wiebeck, director of education at Houston's Holocaust Museum. The museum recently invited Haider Elias to give a talk there.
I think that connecting to that heart and finding people that can communicate with that is really, really essential to all of us.
The Holocaust Museum audience listened carefully as Elias talked about the history of the Yazidi people's religious persecution.
They were left traumatized and they were forced to put their lives in halt.
Since leaving Iraq, Elias has become a vocal advocate for the Yazidi community. He says getting support from such diverse groups gives him hope about the future of refugees in Texas. In Houston, I'm Saida Hassan for Marketplace.
Coming up,
things like on-time arrival, cancellations, mishandled bags, bumped passengers. United has reliably performed worst among all non-discount airlines.
Can United Airlines make you love it again? But first, let's do the numbers. Domestic markets were closed today because of the Martin Luther King holiday. And given the market slump last week, Wall Street may be grateful for the breather. But foreign markets were open. In Asian markets, the Hang Seng was off 1.4%. Japan's Nikkei fell 1.1%, and the Shanghai Composite grew 0.4%. In Europe, Britain's FTSE lost 0.4%. France's CAC 40 was off nearly 0.5%, and Germany's DAX lost 0.25%. Oil prices continued to slide below $30 a barrel. There's speculation about sub-$20 oil, and investors are keeping a close eye on Iran's oil exports now that sanctions are lifted. You're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Now to Southern Africa, where Mozambique has a booming economy. Its rich coal, mineral, and gas reserves have led to 7% annual growth for almost 20 years now. But it's still one of the poorest countries in the world. And there's frustration that not enough of that commodity wealth has been spread around. Mozambique's capital, Maputo, has a skyline full of skyscrapers, but the streets below are still a mess of traffic and poor drainage. Now, a huge road-building project promises to modernize the roads that encircle the city. But there's still no consensus on what its impact will be. The BBC's Tony Bonsignor reports.
The new ring road is meant to transform Maputo's infrastructure, but it's come at a high price. First, there's a financial cost. Hundreds of millions of dollars already spent with no end in sight. And then there's the human cost, with thousands of families forcibly relocated to new homes outside the city.
When I was told about the move, I was very enthusiastic about it, but I thought we were going to a better place. I thought I was going to improve my life. But now we are very far away from where we can buy things. We spend a lot of money in transport. It's opposite from what I was dreaming before I changed.
A few kilometers further on is the relatively prosperous town of Marikwene, a city that's hoping to benefit greatly from the ring road and capitalize on its picturesque beachside location. The town's administrator, Maria Vicente, played a key role in the relocation project.
A lot of people have had to move as a result of this project, be resettled, many of them in this district here. We've spoken to some people who are very upset, who have moved a long way out of town. How many of those stories have you heard? What are you doing about it?
It's true that, as you know, the development of any country has got its difficulties. The areas where everybody wanted to be resettled could not accommodate everybody. And our priority was to place people where they have access to basic facilities like electricity and water and schools and higher education. Our priority was to give a piece of land to those whose homes were demolished. We don't want anybody to sleep under the sun, to get wet. Some people had to be given plots in areas where they can only wait.
Well, we've had a quick walk down this street. It's quite a quiet street, few businesses, some school children around, not an awful lot happening. If this developed in the way you want it to, what would I see in a few years' time that I'm not seeing now?
You will see hotels and you will see intense business activity given the potential of Marikwene. We're already building a bridge which will make this place a magnet of tourism. We think we can attract many people to come and invest their money here.
Well, whether the Maputo Ring Road and then this bridge really does spur tourism to this area remains to be seen. Whether that tourism comes and then perhaps ruins part of this area is also another question for the future.
That's the BBC's Tony Bonsignor. Since the mega merger between United and Continental Airlines 5 years ago, United has had some tough flying. It scores among the lowest of any major airline in most major categories. There was the scandal involving its former CEO, Jeff Smyzek. He is under federal investigation for allegedly trading favors with the New Jersey Port Authority. His replacement, Oscar Munoz, has been trying very hard to clean up United's act, but he's had serious health issues, including a recent heart transplant. Drake Bennett is a staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. He wrote about United's struggle for a comeback. Hi, Drake. Good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
There's some pretty shocking stuff in here about United's performance, let's say, over the last few years. Start out by telling me a little bit about what you found.
Well, if you look at the numbers, the kind of performance metrics that airlines are measured by, things like on-time arrival, cancellations, mishandled bags, bumped passengers, United has reliably performed worst among all non-discount airlines. They've also made customers less happy than any other major airline. And then you have these particularly vivid anecdotes that for a lot of people seem to symbolize the United experience. Things like a disabled man who had to crawl off a plane because there wasn't an aisle wheelchair to take him to the jetway, or a little girl whose parents couldn't find her because no one had met her at her flight when it arrived at O'Hare and she was traveling as an unaccompanied minor. You hear a lot of stories like this, and you also hear a lot of stories just about how people feel like they're unable to get through to anyone at United to tell them about their problems or to fix things, that there's really just this sense that employees of the airline don't really have a lot of agency to help out customers. And so customers have really turned on the airline, especially in the first couple of years. They lost a lot of very lucrative business travelers, which is really the lifeblood for these non-discount airlines.
Right, absolutely. Although it seems like 2015 was still a very profitable year for United. Why? What accounts for that?
Well, a lot of it is simply the fact that jet fuel was historically cheap. So all the airlines made money. United had actually hedged against the drop in jet fuel prices. And despite that, making that poor decision, they still made an enormous amount of money. If you look at the number of people traveling on United, the amount of money United is able to make per traveler, both of those things have stayed pretty flat or even gone down recently. So I think the challenge for the airline is continuing to make money when conditions are less favorable, which they inevitably at some point will be.
How much of this is really a leadership issue? You talk about decisions like hedging, you know, locking in higher fuel prices. But I mean, this Jeffrey Smizek investigation by the Department of Justice aside, seems like he was pretty checked out.
Yeah, I do think there are certain decisions you can point to Smizek and the leadership of the airline getting wrong. Things like how they dealt with merging the two technology systems of the two airlines. They did it all in one day, which is a really high stakes way to do things, and ended up backfiring because you had weeks and months of delays. You also really have a sense, and I think if you talk to employees, you talk to customers, you talk to Wall Street analysts, there's a sense that United was really focused very much on the bottom line, on getting these savings out of the merger that they had promised to Wall Street. And they did get a lot of those savings. The problem is they did it in a way that managed to very much annoy their employees and also their customers. And so you have a lot of people feeling like a lot of the amenities they were used to were gone, and also just the basic blocking and tackling that's required to get flights in on time with all their bags and things like that, that are often the most important thing to travelers.
Smizek obviously removed pretty abruptly because of this investigation.
Bridgegate,
Oscar Munoz comes in, and it does feel like there have been changes, but obviously pretty big challenges with his health, right?
Right, exactly. I think Munoz really from the get-go made it his number one priority to reintroduce the airline to customers and also to employees. They've obviously made it a priority to wrap up union negotiations, which were something that had been hanging over the airline for a long time. And also just to kind of reintroduce all these things that sort of charm customers. They're now free snacks on United flights. And these things seem little, but they do get noticed. One of the first things he did, Oscar Munoz, was called up Gordon Bethune, who was this much-beloved CEO at Continental back in the 90s who turned the airline around, and just had him to Chicago and talk to him about how to kind of revive the reputation of the airline. And you see certain of these things coming out of the playbook that Continental used back in the 90s to very dramatically go from being one of the worst airlines in the country to one of the best.
All right, we'll be watching. That's Drake Bennett, staff writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks a lot, Drake.
Thank you.
And this final note before we go, the World Economic Forum starts this week in Davos, Switzerland, and as if to kickstart some talking points, Oxfam International released the results of a study it conducted on global economic health. The study finds that 62 people now control as much wealth as half of the rest of the world combined. The report is provocatively titled An Economy for the 1%. It found that the wealth of the poorest 3.6 billion people fell by $1 trillion just since 2010. And the wealth of those richest 62, who are mostly men, by the way, increased by $500 billion in the same time frame. And back then, in 2010, the good old days of only slightly less wealth inequality, a whopping 388 people controlled the bulk of the wealth in the world. It's obviously dropped pretty quickly since then. The Oxfam report blames international tax havens for letting people stash trillions of tax-free dollars overseas. It also said companies are not increasing wages for most workers, but are increasing pay to their executives. All right, that's all the time we've got for today. Domestic markets were closed because of the Martin Luther King holiday. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood. Marketplace will be back tomorrow. This is APM.